court will proceed to the second case of the day, Patterson v. Indiana Newspapers. Mr. Newman.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, because of our limited time, I will touch upon just some.
I would suggest to you that you do not have limited time. When you get 20 minutes in this court, that's a generous amount of time. We normally have arguments of lesser time.
So. I noticed that, Your Honor. Thank you. In any event, I will touch upon just some of the critical parts of the case. The first is the district court's sealed entry on the motion for protective order issued on November 1, 2006, which is document 76 in the court below. And due to the nature of that sealed order, I will only discuss it generally, but the order did state in pertinent part, according to the plaintiffs, certain non-parties were affiliated with the gay community, and this affiliation motivated them to behave in a hostile manner against those that they perceived to be anti-gay due to their religious beliefs. And therefore, at the deposition of these non-parties, the defendants had the option of instructing the witness not to answer certain questions, but then to stipulate for purposes of summary judgment that the court may assume that the answers would have supported plaintiff's allegations. And those questions, Your Honors, are listed on pages 23 and 24 of the appellant's sealed reply brief. And due to the nature of the order, I won't recount them here, but they do appear in the written briefs. And the defendants did indeed elect not to answer those questions. Therefore, for the purposes of the summary judgment we're here today for, the answers are deemed to support appellant's position that those witnesses were motivated to behave in a hostile manner against the plaintiffs, Dan Patterson and Lisa Coffey, due to their religious beliefs. As a result, I would propose that this evidence is dispositive regarding the issue of whether the Indianapolis Star discriminated against James Patterson and Lisa Coffey due to their religion. And therefore, there's no need to go beyond this and discuss the Star's purported non-discriminatory reasons for its job actions or the issues of pretext, because the Star has essentially conceded that it did take employment action against the plaintiffs due to their religious beliefs. Notwithstanding,
one of the principal issues is, what did the Star do to the plaintiffs that was adverse? Patterson is pretty clear, but the other one is not.
Yes, Your Honor, and I will address that. I can address that now. That would be the issue of the constructive issue or the constructive discharge of Lisa Coffey. And the events leading up to Lisa Coffey's transfer to the copy desk, combined with the transfer itself, Your Honor, did constitute the constructive discharge. Keep in mind,
placed on the copy desk equivalent to a constructive discharge?
In this case, Your Honor, absolutely. Lisa Coffey had 14 years of experience as an editorial writer, both with the Indianapolis News, which was a sister newspaper to the Indianapolis Star, as well as with the Indianapolis Star. And keep in mind what a copy editor does versus an editorial writer. An editorial writer, Your Honor, is the most prestigious position at a newspaper. It's intellectually challenging, it's creative, it's invigorating, especially to a person like Lisa Coffey, who said herself in a March 25, 2002 performance review, quote, "I have an MBA and I am a manager in spirit and talent, not a copy editor."
Well, counsel, the difference between the two positions may make the transfer an adverse employment action, but it certainly doesn't amount to something so oppressive as to be a constructive discharge. That's a very high standard.
Well, it is a high standard, Your Honor, but you have to understand, given the circumstances of the case and the presumed religious discrimination against Lisa Coffey, she would realize that she was now at a dead end in her position. She's been knocked down from the highest position in the newspaper to one of the lowest positions in terms of the writing and editing of the newspaper, going over other people's copy. She isn't writing anything anymore, Your Honor. She's checking for errors. She's checking for spelling. She's writing headlines, things of that. It's a very menial position, Your Honor.
She's not a proofreader. She's a copy editor. I assume there's some difference.
Well, not much, Your Honor, and that's the point. You have a person who had exceedingly high performance reviews leading up to this. Her previous performance review, Your Honor, stated in particular with respect to her situation. Here's what her performance review said just 4.5 months before the management change, which led to her constructive discharge. Lisa is a dedicated, personable member of our staff who, better than anyone, can fill in to perform all job responsibilities connected with the editorial page, writing, content editing, copy editing, page planning, art selection, etc. This makes her invaluable. Her work ethic is exemplary. Here you have the person who got the highest possible rating in the entire editorial department being knocked down to a copy editor. I would submit, Your Honor, that is a constructive discharge. With respect to the issue of overtime as a pretext, first of all, Lisa Coffey was an exempt employee under the federal wage laws because she was a journalist and an exempt creative professional. She also had 14 years with the Indianapolis News and the Indianapolis Star concededly. And everybody agrees with this. She spent long hours at her job every day. Everybody knew this at the News. Everybody knew this at the Star. It was well known by management. It's in the record. And yet she was never before.
She worked as a secretary, didn't she? She wasn't exempt in that capacity.
She did in 2 days a week. She was not a secretary, Your Honor. She was an administrative assistant with regard to the Pulliam Fellowship. But in her other position, there's no question that she was a creative professional.
Why was she claiming the overtime then?
Excuse me?
If she was exempt, why was she claiming the overtime?
She never did claim overtime, Your Honor.
I thought there was an issue with the personnel director about some $5,000 in overtime that she was owed.
It was $5,000. It was not an overtime payment. While she worked with the Pulliam Fellowship, she was being paid by a Pulliam who she was working with in addition to her Star salary. When it became obvious to her that the Star was setting her up to leave, she went to the management and she said, listen, I've been getting all this additional compensation. My pension should reflect that. And the $5,500 was not an overtime payment. It was a lump sum pension payment to reflect the additional compensation she had been paid by Mr. Pulliam as a result of her work at the Pulliam Fellowship. It was not an overtime payment.
So she was paid off the books? She was paid off the books of the newspaper by the sponsor of the fellowship program? Is that?
Essentially, yes. She was being paid additional by Mr. Pulliam, who was also an employee of the newspaper.
And she claimed, based on those payments, that she was entitled to an inflated salary base for her pension, and that's what the $5,000 was the payment for?
Well, an additional salary base, but yes, and that's what the payment was for. It was a lump sum pension payment.
Well, it wasn't a pension payment then. It was an additional amount of salary that she was claiming in order to boost her the level of her pension once she left the paper?
Well, no. It was set up as a lump sum pension payment, and they paid her in cash. I mean, they wrote her a check.
While she was still employed, though, right?
Yes.
So it's not a pension payment.
Well, I used to work in pensions, Your Honor, and I wouldn't call it that, but that's what the Star called it. It was a payment due to an increased pension.
I won't
go into the propriety of it, but that's how they set it up, and that's what they called it. It was definitely not an overtime payment. It was based upon additional wages she was being paid for by Mr. Pulliam. Certainly, you know, the Star argues that Lisa Coffey's additional work and hours she put it in danger of violating the wage and hour laws, but the fact of the matter is it wasn't in danger of it, if that was in truth the fact. They already were in violation of the wage and hour laws because she concededly worked those hours, and yet you never saw the Star make any move to pay her. which,
Counsel,
according to
this dispute strikes me as a struggle over the editorial content of the newspaper after Gannett took over. Is that a fair characterization? And if not, why not?
I would say it's definitely a struggle over the philosophy of the newspaper.
And who's in charge of that? Not your clients, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Absolutely.
So why does this amount to a religious and other discrimination claim?
Because there was never
if
any...
It's just a struggle over the editorial content and philosophy of the paper.
Well, because there was never any claim by the newspaper that either one of these employees were writing religious articles, other than a memo by Ali Zoibi, which he wrote regarding his October 13, 2003 meeting with Lisa Coffey, which totally belies the overtime argument which the paper is proposing. I mean, the paper has not come before this court and suggested what Your Honor is suggesting. They have not come before this court and say, listen, you know, we had employees who did not agree with our new editorial view, therefore we were justified in firing them. They claimed that Lisa Coffey worked unauthorized overtime. They claimed that James Patterson made too many errors and had poor performance. Those are the reasons that they have suggested that they terminated these employees, not the reason Your Honor is suggesting. So that issue is not before the court. What is before the court, with respect to Lisa Coffey, is whether or not this purported overtime issue is pretext. And you have a bunch of shifting reasons which the Star raised. With respect to Ali Zoibi, the head of Human Resources, he states in his memo, I told her she had a responsibility to keep her religious views out of the paper, and she has on several occasions failed to do this. I told her it was clear that her approach and style made her agenda too transparent. In short, Dennis, that being editor Dennis Ryerson, felt that other voices needed to be heard. You had an email exchange in early September between the publisher Barbara Henry and Dennis Ryerson, in which Henry gave an explicit direction, finding non-editorial writing job for Coffey. Ryerson claims that there was no position available for Coffey when she asked him for one, even part-time, and yet he acknowledges to his boss, Barbara Henry, editorial was down a person, and he acknowledged Henry's directive that he hire a writer for the editorial page to replace Coffey. So although the Star comes before this court and says, we transferred Coffey because of overtime issues, clearly the written record shows that they were setting her up. They wanted to find a non-editorial writing job for her in one case, and you have another person in management claiming she was making, you know, religious writing and putting her religious views in the newspaper. None of this adds up. You have three different inconsistent reasons provided by the Star for taking the employment action against Lisa Coffey.
Well, Counsel, my point is that even accepting the alternative explanation that this was motivated by a philosophical struggle over the editorial content of the newspaper and that management thought that Ms. Coffey's religious views were seeping into her work inappropriately, why does that amount to a discrimination claim? Management is entitled to make that judgment and transfer her accordingly. That doesn't amount to religious discrimination. That amounts to a permissible editorial judgment on the part of the management of the paper.
But that isn't what they're bringing before the court, and that's not the reason that they've
raised.
Even
putting your interpretation on the evidentiary record, I know that's not what they're claiming, but accepting your interpretation that this was motivated by a reaction on the part of the new management of the paper to her religious views seeping into her work, what's illegal about that? Management of the newspaper is entitled to make that judgment without subjecting itself or leaving itself open to a religious discrimination claim.
Well, that would be true, except you only have one of those people saying that her religious views have seeped into her editorial content. You say you have Dennis Ryerson in his EEOC claim just stating, you know, she doesn't fit in with the ebb and flow of the newspaper. You don't have a consistent message, Your Honor, that you have an employee here who is letting her religious views seep into her writing. You have a whole bunch of inconsistent messages.
Why are they inconsistent as opposed to arguably complementary, or at least they can coexist as reasons, Mr. Newman? I understand that you argue there's a pretext element here, But why could they not be freestanding reasons, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, whether or not they could be, the Star has not come to before this court and stated that they were. They've hung their hat on one issue. They said, we made a transfer of her because of the fact that she worked unauthorized overtime. And having come before the district court with that argument, that's the argument which they must make here. And then I would show that they've got alternative so-called reasons in the record, and that's pretty basic law. When you have shifting, inconsistent reasons, and management can't decide why on earth they actually took action against an employee, that's evidence of pretext. I would like to... Is that my white light on?
It is.
Okay. I will reserve my argument regarding Mr. Patterson for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. Let me start out by addressing the big picture issue that Your Honor raised with respect to the trying to control the editorial content of the paper. And I'd like to focus the Court's attention on a critical fact as the background to all of the particulars in this case, and that is the allegation in the complaint from the get-go was that Ms. Henry and Mr. Ryerson engaged in a conspiracy to purge from the Star those people that didn't view homosexuality as incompatible with the biblical teachings. That did view homosexuality as incompatible with biblical teachings. Coffey has testified that she believed homosexuality is sinful. Mr. Patterson believed that and testified in his deposition that homosexuality is abominable in the sight of God. The problem, the big problem with the plaintiff's theory stems from this fact that the two highest-ranking persons in the editorial department throughout the relevant time frame were Tim Swearens and Andrea Neal. And both Mr. Swearens and Ms. Neal have averred that they are traditional Christians in the way that term was used by Ms. Coffey and Mr. Patterson throughout this litigation, which is they believe, Mr. Swearens, Ms. Neal, that homosexuality is incompatible with biblical teachings. That is in Neal's affidavit, which is part of our Sup A at 325D, and Swearens' affidavit, paragraph 25, at Sup A 292. If your objective was to purge from the paper persons who had a different view of homosexuality than you did, then the logical place to start would be the highest-ranking position in the paper with respect to editorials. That would be Ms. Swearens and Ms. Neal. And that is exactly where the plaintiffs tried to go at the beginning of this case. Before Ms. Neal was deposed, each of them testified to their belief, to their conviction, that Ms. Neal was terminated by the Star because of her beliefs on homosexuality being incompatible with the teachings of the Bible. Ms. Coffey testified specifically that Ms. Neal felt scorn and derision as a result of her beliefs. She testified that Ryerson pressured Ms. Neal to take a more liberal slant in the editorials. Mr. Patterson testified that Neal was distraught over both Mr. Ryerson and Ms. Henry's pressuring her, and that Andrea Neal was forced out because she opposed homosexuality. That was their testimony under oath, and it was a necessary component of their theory in this case that the Star was attempting to purge this thought process. Remarkably, when Ms. Neal testified under oath, she discredited and contradicted these claims in every material respect. If you look at her affidavit, which is in our supplemental appendix, she said, first of all, that Mr. Ryerson was really very pleasant to her. In her affidavit, she rejected outright at paragraph 11 that she was under any pressure to change her more conservative views while she was at the Star. In paragraph 24 of her affidavit, she testified that she was not a victim of discrimination, nor was she did she witness discrimination against anyone based on religion, including Ms. Coffey and Mr. Patterson. And she says, with respect to the proselytizing email about which there's been much debate in the briefs, she said it was her, Neal, that admonished Ms. Coffey that it was inappropriate for her to send such a proselytizing email at work, that Ryerson did not instruct her to take any disciplinary action towards Ms. Coffey, did not express anger, and that he didn't take any disciplinary action against Ms. Neal. Ms. Neal also averred that, and testified in her deposition that she left not because of any pressure she felt at the Star, but she wanted to pursue her calling as a teacher. Now, after she left, if your thought process, if you really wanted to further a conspiracy to eliminate the voice of persons who oppose homosexuality as being incompatible with the teachings of the Bible, this was a golden opportunity for them to select such a person. They did not. They selected Tim Swearens, they being Barbara Henry and Tim, or Dennis Ryerson. Tim Swearens averred, paragraph 25 of his deposition, that he too believes that homosexuality is incompatible with the teachings of the Bible. So they replaced a traditional Christian in the top editorial position reporting to Mr. Ryerson with another traditional Christian. They are not telling the truth to your honors when they say in their brief that, quote, Patterson was the only traditional Christian in editorial. That's on page 10 of their opening brief. They're not telling
well,
the truth.
Well, if all this is the case, why did you propose this overtime matter as your defense?
Well, with respect to Ms. Coffey, I think the
I mean, I think there is something to the situation that you, at different times and different places, proposed different reasons for whatever actions you took.
Your Honor, I think if you look at the affidavits of Mr. Ryerson and his deposition testimony, the affidavit of Ali Zobi, that it is clear, and the affidavit of Andrea Neal, all of them, and I think Neal's testimony is particularly critical on this point, Your Honor, where she says that on multiple occasions she talked to Lisa Coffey about not working overtime, that it was a problem in editorial, and that I think is in paragraph 12 of Andrea Neal's affidavit. The problem with overtime, paragraph 19, the problem with overtime went back to Andrea Neal. The issue was broached with Ali Zobi by Ms. Coffey, back to the questions asked, I think, of counsel during his presentation. She raised the issue that she had worked overtime, had not been credited for it, and as a result, her pension was depleted or was not as much as it should have been. In the context of addressing those overtime issues, Mr. Zobi, this being the first occasion that he knew of the overtime issue, admonished her that she was not to work overtime without pre-approval, and with respect to whether or not she was paid for overtime, it is undisputed. And Coffey confirmed in her deposition that the lump sum payment she received was for unpaid overtime. That is at our Sup A, tab 5, 173. She had raised this issue. She had been admonished first by Neal, then by Zobi when Zobi found out, by Ryerson when he found out, and eventually Tim Swearens in his affidavit testified that she went through 50 hours of the department's approved 60 hours of overtime for the year without approval. This was a major problem. It had been a major problem all the way back to Andrea Neal. And as a result, when Zobi was confronted with this and as manager of HR, he recognized it as a serious problem, told her to stop. And the record is undisputed. Ms. Coffey testified in her deposition. She, in fact, worked unauthorized overtime after that meeting with Ali Zobi, where she sent him an email, I believe, and said, oops, I did it again, in so many words. This was not a made-up issue. It was only when it was raised to Zobi, when it was raised to that level, whereas HR manager and responsible for protecting the legal interests of the Star, he made the outright instruction to Ms. Coffey not to work overtime. And it is clear that she was not an exempt employee. And I would like to direct the court's attention to what I think is a very important paragraph in Andrea Neal's deposition. It also relates to the constructive discharge issue. That is with respect to what the duties of Ms. Coffey were. Ms. Coffey was not an exempt employee. She claimed overtime because she knew she was not an exempt employee. It's clear from the record. Ms. Neal's affidavit at paragraph 5 basically describes Ms. Coffey as a utility player. She did everything. She was part-time editorial, part-time administrative assistant for the Pulliam internship, and she writes, Andrea Neal in her deposition, that during the time she was working 3 days per week in editorials, Lisa's assignments were not limited to writing editorial columns. In fact, she frequently filled in for then-editorial copy editor Jane Lichtenberg. She was doing copy editing work while Neal was her supervisor. When filling in for Jane, Lisa would lay out the page, do copy editing of the editorials, and column slated for print and write headlines. I also assigned Lisa some special project, such as copying and the assembly of election endorsement binders. This is not the work of an exempt employee, and certainly when it comes to the issue of a constructive discharge, for her to claim that she was suddenly, when offered a full-time copy editor's job, being demoted, that is inconsistent with the testimony of Andrea Neal all the way back to when she was supervising her work. Certainly it's consistent with Mr. Swearin's testimony as well. With respect to Mr. Zoebe's notes, I'd like to point out to the court that that was not argued below, the issues that were raised with the inconsistencies. We've argued in our brief that, therefore, those are waived. There also is, as we've argued, no inconsistency. Mr. Zoebe was simply reflecting the conversation that Ms. Coffey had initiated with him. His notes reflected her comments to him. So those arguments are of no moment. The plaintiff's burden with respect to Coffey, and I'll make this point, move to Mr. Patterson, was to show that she was constructively discharged. And as this court has noted in the EEOC case that's cited in our brief, she has to show that she suffered something beyond ordinary discrimination, something very severe. She did not. And, in fact, you will recall from the record that on the day of her departure, she sent an incredibly glowing email to Barbara Henry. We've argued, and the court below relied upon this in part to show that there was, in fact, no constructive discharge, where she writes, again, contrary to the view that there is a religious conspiracy, "I just wanted to thank you sincerely for allowing me the privilege of working here at the Star. I have enjoyed and appreciated more than I can say the past 13 years. I know Harvey Jacobs, who hired me, would have been proud knowing you," that's Barbara Henry, "returned here to serve as publisher. He was such a good man. He was extremely fond of you. I wish you the best in both your career and life." This was an opportunity for Ms. Coffey to express her outrage and disappointment of having to leave. She didn't do that. She did exactly the opposite. Briefly, to make sure that I touch on this point with respect to the protective order, and then I'll move to Mr. Patterson. The protective order, present counsel for the plaintiffs was not counsel of record at the time that the negotiations for that protective order occurred. It was prior counsel. If you review the record, what we asked the protective order for, the limited basis, and we're aware of this circuit's and the district court's reticency to enter protective orders on a broad scale, only asked that the sexual preferences of the sexual orientation of two individuals, both non-parties, not be permitted to be disclosed during the depositions. We argued for nothing more. We said that the views of all of the witnesses on the topics, their thought process, was fair game, and we had no objection to that and sought no protective order over it. Only the identities of the two whose sexual preference they attempted to impugn, our view being that their preference had nothing to do with the views that they have with respect to people in the workplace. That order was entered on a very, very limited basis. And my objections in the deposition were only to those questions that called for the witness to acknowledge sexual orientation, which violated the court's protective order. That's the limited basis. The record will support that if you go back and look at what was requested. With respect to Mr. Patterson, and I have to use my full 20 minutes. I don't think I get to reserve any time. So I will not have the opportunity to hear the arguments on Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Newman will be rebutting your arguments. He will not be raising new arguments for Mr. Patterson because that is time management is the issue for both sides.
All right.
You will face rebuttal on what you argue.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to Mr. Patterson, the issues with respect to his organization and writing went all the way back to Andrea Neal. Again, Andrea Neal's importance in this case. Andrea Neal specifically says that he was the worst editorial writer, needed the most corrections of any other editorial writer. An independent writing consultant confirmed that, and that's in the record, and the district court referred to that in its opinion. Mr. Swearens testified that Mr. Patterson needed greater editorializing than any other editorial writer that he had. That's was his point from the moment that he became Mr. Patterson's supervisor.
Kept him on the job for quite a while, though, in spite of that.
He had been on the job for some time, Your Honor. Certainly, there are cases in the district out of the circuit that note that even when an employee has been employed for as long as 20 years, their past performance is not so much the issue as the performance at the time. What we've argued is that while it's clear Neal, and part of this goes to pretext, Neal, a traditional Christian, had identified Patterson as having weaknesses in this area. So the issue of is there a pretext in the Star's articulated reasons for identifying this as a legitimate business reason for his determination doesn't hold up, because both Neal and Mr. Swearens, as traditional Christians, identified this as the issue. But this is not a new made-up issue. It was all the way back to Neal. I think it's fair to say, if you look at the record, though, that Mr. Swearens was equally disturbed, and this is clear from his affidavit, not just at the errors, but at the lack of accountability that Mr. Patterson had when those errors were presented to him. The point was, with the independent writing consultant who told Mr. Patterson that he needed to improve organization and precision, Mr. Patterson says in his deposition, as argued below, I disagreed with him. When Ms. Neal pointed out that he had errors, he disagreed with her. When Mr. Swearens noted that these errors, the two critical errors in the Humane Society article and the American Trans Air article, were his responsibility, he disclaimed responsibility, even though it was clear that he had, in Tim Swearens' view, breached journalistic ethics. And I will say, if you look at Ms. Coffey's testimony below, she agreed that what Mr. Patterson did breached journalistic ethics when he didn't go check the sources himself. He says he relied upon the research of others. Ms. Coffey testified below that she would never do that she considered it a breach of journalistic ethics, and that as a editorial writer, you were responsible for doing all your own research and checking the facts. This is especially important with respect to editorial writers, Your Honor, because these aren't all articles or columns where people have a byline and they put their name. When you write an editorial, you are writing it for the Star as Star, and the errors that you make are significant because they reflect on the credibility of the paper. They're more significant because they reflect on the credibility of the paper. Mr. Swearens was concerned that after placing Mr. Patterson on PIP for the Humane Society debacle, that he later then made the same error for the American Trans Air article, which is he failed to run a source to ground. He failed to check his facts. This is a critical deficiency for an editorial writer. And I will say, if you look at the record, the plaintiffs, this point bears mentioning, the plaintiffs never deposed Tim Swearens. I want the court to focus on the decision maker, the person who recommended that Mr. Patterson be terminated, the person that placed him on the PIP, was never deposed in this case. They ran from Tim Swearens as a witness. They did not want him to speak. They did not want him on the record. And look at the briefs at the summary judgment stage. They ignore him in the briefing, even after the Star, in its reply brief, advocated that the Tim Swearens' centrality in the Patterson disciplinary actions leading to termination undermined their claims. The reason is they knew that Tim Swearens was a significant problem. They never put themselves in a position, and on this record, to make a true comparator or similarly situated or pretext argument, because they never asked Tim Swearens the questions. Was there anybody else who made the same mistakes that Mr. Patterson made? Was there anybody else who failed to check sources and run it to ground in the way that Mr. Patterson did? Who else did you place on a performance improvement plan? Why did you place them? Why did you not? None of those questions were ever asked by the plaintiffs of the critical witness in this case, which is Tim Swearens. For them to make the argument, for instance, that Mr. Swearin's affidavit does not identify him as a traditional Christian, A, is false. Mr. Swearin uses the same language that Ms. Neal uses, which is that he believes that homosexuality is incompatible with Christianity. But it's a hollow claim because they were in a position to run that to ground themselves, to evaluate and test Mr. Swearin's thought process and his consistency in the application of his view on what an editorial writer should be doing with regard to checking and rechecking facts, what errors were acceptable or permissible. They never did it. Last point on on this topic. I see my time is coming to a close. The workload issue. They argue in their brief that the most telling point with respect to the errors and the pretext argument or that it establishes pretext is that he was required to work more under Swearin's than he had under Neal. That is false. It's in Neal's, performance plans or the performance evaluations that she performed with plaintiff, she specifically identifies Mr. Patterson as doing 3 to 4 editorials in one column a week. In his testimony, Patterson testified under Swearin's she drafted 5 editorials and 0 columns weekly. 5 to 5 in terms of the written work product. Absolute falsehood that there was any change in the level of the work other than the contradictory affidavits which were submitted and which the district court properly rejected. Finally, I would just note for your honors, I see my time is over, that the district court noted that all of these factual issues that are raised by the plaintiffs, both below and here, will be resolved against them to the extent that they could have been addressed following Rule 56.1. You recall in the court's order, the court noted that the plaintiffs had not complied with the local rule and specifically identified where there was a factual dispute as to the material facts the Star identified. So as plaintiff argues to you about all of the error in the court's evaluation of the facts, I just call your attention to their noncompliance with the local rule and this court's past precedent indicating that is fatal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Yerkes. Mr. Newman.
With respect to counsel's last argument, there are 6 pages of disputed facts listed in the summary judgment brief, and I would encourage this court to independently review that and see that the district court was mistaken. With regard to Andrea Neal and whether or not she felt any pressure from the new management, she stated in her deposition, the management at the time did not want to have an editorial page that was perceived as anti-gay. I don't think we wrote any editorials opposing gay marriage. I was reluctant. I felt my superiors disagreed with that position, and I didn't want to battle. With respect to Mr. Swearin's and whether or not he's a traditional Christian, he had a very carefully worded affidavit, Your Honors. It stated, quote, "It is my belief that homosexual practice is incompatible with biblical and Christian teachings." He did not say that he personally has that kind of belief, only that he recognizes it's incompatible with biblical and Christian teachings, and that's no different than what Mr. Ryerson said, acknowledging that Catholicism condemns homosexuality and same-sex marriage, yet admitting that he personally has no problem with it. With respect to the protective order issue, Your Honor, I would encourage the court again to review those particular questions, and you can see that the objections raised by counsel were to questions that went well beyond merely the sexual orientation of the witnesses. With respect to James Patterson and counsel's argument that Andrea Neal said he was the worst writer, if you review Andrea Neal's performance review in January of 2003, once again, just a few months before the management change, she did recognize certain weaknesses in his writing, yet despite recognizing those weaknesses, she gave him superior assessments in all performance objectives. She stated he was rated, quote, "met all objectives of the job and sometimes exceeded the expectations in some areas, in particular with respect to writing quality and reporting and research." So her take on Mr. Patterson was quite a bit different than alluded to by counsel. With respect to Mr. Swearin's, he testified that he was, quote, "surprised when he became editorial page editor in mid-2003 at Mr. Patterson's errors, and yet you have to remember that Tim Swearin, since 2001, had been the assistant editorial page editor, that Mr. Patterson testified in his deposition or his affidavit that everybody in the editorial department reviewed each other's work. So Mr. Swearin should have been quite familiar with Mr. Patterson's work for years before he became editorial page editor, and for him to say that at that point in time he became surprised at Mr. Patterson's performance just decries credibility. With respect to the argument that Mr. Swearin had a problem with Mr. Patterson's lack of accountability, particularly with respect to the issue of the ATA editorial. Remember, when you look at the facts of that editorial, the editorial board, which includes everybody in the editorial department, plus publisher Barbara Henry, plus Dennis Ryerson, including Tim Swearin, the editorial board voted to endorse ATA before it assigned the editorial to James Patterson. So the decision had been made by the editorial board, by Barbara Henry, by Dennis Ryerson, by Tim Swearin. We, as the newspaper, are going to endorse ATA before they assign the editorial to James Patterson. So where was it in James Patterson's responsibility then to ferret out what the other side, a competing bidder, had to do? He wasn't given the assignment to do that investigation and to present the information to the board so it could make its decision. The board had already made its decision. His job was to write an editorial supporting the decision that had already been made by Barbara Henry, Dennis Ryerson, Tim Swearin, the entire board, and that's exactly what he did. And only after the paper got a lot of flack from the competing bidder did suddenly the finger pointing go to James Patterson and saying, you were the cause for the problem. That's simply not true, Your Honors. With respect to the workload issue, I think if you review the actual record, you'll see that in the record, James Patterson was given the heaviest workload. That simply is not believable if you say he had the highest error rate, that he would be given that heaviest workload. And also it would explain, if he did have the highest error rate, why he did, because he did the most work. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Thank you, Mr. Yerkes. The case is taken under advisement.